This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 67, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. My mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases, and other related events. And every Thursday I release an episode called Paranormal Stories, and that has UFO cases, as well as information on evidence of an afterlife. If you want to hear the extended version of this episode, which is an extra 24 minutes, you'll need to join the Patreon campaign, where there are now over 60 episodes in the back catalogue. If you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe. This week I'm talking to Steve Hammond about his book, The Scottish UFO Casebook. Steve has had an interest in UFOs throughout his life. He ran the Anglo-Scottish UFO Research Association website and has had a few sightings, but says most of them are explicable. He was co-writer on the original Grand Theft Auto, as well as the games Hired Guns and Body Harvest. Hi Steve, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Morning Simon, happy to be here.
So we're going to be talking about your book. It's called The Scottish UFO Casebook. First of all, can I ask, where did you get all these sightings from?
Well, that was the interesting thing. Began having an interest in UFOs, there was always no information available, which is to say there was information, but it just wasn't accessible for me in the 1970s. When the lockdown hit, I had a few projects, you know, going on in the background. I thought, you know, this would be the perfect time to start looking at UFO cases. Because two things had happened. One, I'd had my attention drawn to the Archives for the Unexplained, which is an online set of scanned magazines, zines, and newsletters, which was a huge information resource. And the other thing that happened, because of lockdown, the National Archives had waived their download fee. To get a PDF from the National Archives, it would have been, I think, about £3. The entire archive being priced at over 400 quid in normal times, it just wouldn't have been possible to do this. So it turns out one of the things I love doing is researching. So there's National Archives, the Archives for the Unexplained, and the third part of it was the National Library of Scotland, which has a number of newspaper archives. So I just put in the search terms, got anything that looked interesting, and wrote it up.
One of the things I like about the book is at the beginning you go so far back in time. There's one I picked out from 1685 from John Nisbet and his son James Nisbet, and I like the language they use where they say, suddenly the clouds clave asunder.
Yeah.
Could you go over a couple of the really old ones, those cases there?
Well, that's the interesting thing, isn't it? Because they all use the language of the time. You know, the Sabbath night before he was taken, you know, they heard a noise and were much amazed. They said to one another, what may that mean? So it's obviously something that wasn't familiar to them. The furthest back I've been able to find is 80 AD. One fast aerial ship, and air seemed to burn. I mean, we might think of that as being, you know, a meteor or a bolide or something of that nature, but the people in the past would have seen those things too. So to be something sufficiently unusual to be commented on, well, you know, it's worth paying attention to. So, like it's with the book said, but I think my favourite one of the early days, I found a few accounts in the Scotsman all over Scotland describing a phenomenon looked like electrically lighted signaller apparatus. Its appearance was rather that of an ill-defined space than that of a shape, but it occasionally showed a sharp and brilliantly lighted edge and contour. And this is in 1908. And that wasn't the only witness. There was another corroborating sighting that described as there was a light haze in the sky, not dense enough to obscure the stars. In this haze were clearly visible over a wide area quick flashes of white light, like a faint aurora. And, you know, it goes on like this. So we have something that, like, back in those days, there wasn't as much light pollution, electrical lighting not as widespread, you know, so there were less things that you could mistake for something unusual. Aurora would have been familiar, and this was a bit different.
You kind of classify those cases before 1947, and 1947 was a kind of a year where it all took off in UFOs, so to speak. And before that, there was the Foo Fighters and the Second World War.
Yeah.
And then before that, there was the odd report now and then, nowhere near as many as nowadays. But I wonder if there were a lot, but they just never got reported because they didn't have newspapers way back then like we do now and are keeping records the way we do now. Or it was a thing where the ETs were kind of watching the planet every now and then, but suddenly an atom bomb start blowing up and they think, oh, now we really have to pay attention.
Yeah. I did debate with myself whether 1947 was a good cutoff point for the past versus the modern era. But I'm happy with that choice because it was in the post-World War II years that the space age began. And I think this, you know, being space and being technological and becoming widespread, you know, we've got television taken off, we've got widespread radio, and we do have newspaper archives or newspaper reports, but it would only really be local newspaper sightings. Prior to that, it's what I said about the language that the Covenanters used and the language that the people in the past used. With the technological age, people got a new vocabulary. We knew now, certainly, come up to the 50s, 1957, there were plans for humans themselves to go into space, to build rockets, to build satellites. It was a subject that was in the air, so to speak. So we had those as reference terms when we're talking about this phenomenon. And you're saying, whether the aliens were watching us. One of the points where I diverge from, I think, probably most ufologists is I'm not convinced it is aliens. I think there's something unusual happening, but calling it aliens is using contemporary vocabulary. Like in the past, you would call them ghosts, spirits. Certainly in Scotland, we've got a whole lot of mythological creatures. The Green Man, Ben McDee, Nessie, to take a very obvious one. But prior to 1947, those were the terms that we'd use. I mentioned in the introduction to my book about, and this was an actual case, that a couple saw a green glowing piper at the side of the road. Now, if we see a green glowing piper at the side of the road, we call that a ghost. But if the green glowing shape happens to wear a spacesuit, we call it a UFO entity. So why do we make that distinction? And I think it's just it's something similar that's happening, but we now perceive it differently.
And is it the psychosocial hypothesis?
Yes. I've got to admit, I'm a big fan of that. Jacques Vallée was quite influential. But more than that, I started to think in this way after about 1996. I was sitting at my desk and just writing up an article. And I just happened to look out the window and I saw this translucent glowing disc. Now, you might expect, oh, it's a UFO. Oh, no, jump up and down. You're under the circles. Oh, no, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. This is incredible. But the reaction, my reaction was just fascinating in retrospect. They're just like, oh, yeah. Oh, I've got my camera sitting there. Took a couple of pictures, which later turned out blank. And got back to the article. And the thing was, the article, at that very moment, I was writing about the psychosocial hypothesis. The idea that UFOs might be a projection or, some sort of internal thing. So was that a hallucination I had? Did I want to see this enough that I actually saw it? And when I got the photos developed, it was just a picture of the buildings opposite with no UFO to be seen. Now you'll be familiar with Jenny Randall's Oz Factor.
Yeah.
Which I know found in a number of cases in the book where everything becomes unnaturally quiet. And I think a similar thing was happening here because everything just felt completely unreal. I didn't have normal reactions. It was almost dreamlike. But because I did have those photos, I know that it did actually happen. It did take place in the day while I was awake. I almost forgot about it the instant that it happened. I think it was about 2 months before I got the spool developed. And for younger listeners, you know, we had to develop spool in a shop, you know, not like digital cameras nowadays. So this is when I started thinking, well, maybe it's not literal nuts and bolts aliens. And one of the things that was surprising, you know, once I had compiled that list for the book, was just how unlike the American experience it all was. I mean, you know, in America, it's, you know, there's even such a thing as, you know, the standard abduction scenario, where it happens in a particular, it starts off in a particular way, it continues in a particular way, it ends in a particular way. And I found one case in Scotland. And I'm wondering, well, why is that? You know, there surely should be more. Maybe perhaps, you know, there are more in the files of Malcolm Robinson and Ron Halliday and so forth. But the ones that have made it to the newspapers, the news clipping services, and the UFO zines don't seem to bear that out. So, you know, one classic abduction case, which isn't to say there haven't been other entity sightings, but they have all been different. There's one called Quickfoot, or one that the 14 Times dubbed Quickfoot, where your family driving a car saw this entity running quickly alongside the car and disappeared in a flash. And that seems to be a feature of Scottish entity sightings, that they're running quickly. I think there's about 3 cases, including that one, where a creature just, you know, ran, you know, 40, 50 miles an hour and then vanished, which is quite remarkable. So is this Scottish culture informing the phenomenon, whereas American culture informs the phenomenon over there?
I was going to mention something you say in the book is about how there were early reports of strange craft, like it was like the steam-powered craft. Victorians would say they saw these craft moving over them and maybe even talk to the people that were flying them. But there's no historical record of these craft ever being built and flown. And it's almost like the technology that people were seeing, and they might be like this today, is beyond us, but just a bit beyond us. It's like in the 50s, people would say, they go inside the craft and say they were controlled by large levers and push buttons.
Yeah, that's right. It's called the cultural tracking, where the craft that are seen are just slightly ahead of what we can actually do now. Ahead, but still conceivable. So for what you mentioned, the airships in Britain, that would be 1909, Phantom airships, which have a bit more capability than the real airships had when they came along a little later. And what's fascinating to me is that, and I read a book about this recently, about phantom aircraft, which happened after the airships. You know, they mainly took place in the 1930s, the early 1940s. You know, aircraft with lights were seen circling, and of course, they're just a bit faster than the aircraft of the day, circling around and seen a bit longer than a normal aircraft could have had fuel. You know, skip another decade and start getting things like phantom satellites. I do have one case in there. I think somebody looking at the telecommunications satellite Echo One, and it was being trailed by another light. So that's a phantom satellite sighting. I've put it all under the rubric of UFOs. Okay, we get the US Department of Defense messing things up. Some information good, some information not so good. And then we get which I think is the myth of, you know, what was it, Black Mike? The supposed satellite that's connected with signals from...
Yeah, I've heard of that.
From Epsilon Booties, yeah. Yeah, that was a Duncan Lunan claim to decode signals from there in around 1973, thereabouts. And that seems to have got mixed in with a satellite theory. But we've got phantom satellites. And in the present day, we now have phantom drone sightings. So it's just slightly ahead of what current drones can do. You know, we've got drones that can fly around for a certain amount of time. We've got the phantom drones that last a bit longer, fly a bit faster, and end up being mysterious. So what happens next? You know, what is the phantom aerial sighting of the 2030s, the 2040s going to be? You know, this is the question that interests me.
And you say in the book that perhaps we'll start finding mystery artificial intelligence showing up.
Yes. Now, this is a pet theory of mine, and I wrote that about 3 months before reports came in the news about this Google engineer claiming that a Google AI had become sentient. So I'm wondering, you know, we've obviously had chatbots, you know, for, you know, many, many years, which, you know, can claim to be, you know, intelligent. They're not really. I've had the runaround from Adobe, you know, on their website, you know, in years past, trying to get something sorted with an obvious chatbot. But then we get sightings. There was a case I remember way back in the 80s where somebody said, and I wish I was able to track this down, but somebody said they were getting messages from the future on their BBC micro computer, and this is a 1980s home computer. So I think it all comes under the heading of the other. You know, up until now, or, well, let's say up until 1947 or the 40s, thereabouts, you know, the other was the supernatural creatures, you know, the uncanny. In the modern era, it's the other intelligence. Well, they can only come from other planets, you know, other stars. So they are aliens. And I'm wondering if in the future the other will become AIs, because what we call AI now, large language models, they're essentially a very clever trick to do statistical analysis. You know, we wouldn't call them intelligent, but they can seem to be. So is it that unlikely that we'll have sightings of what seems to be an AI just slightly ahead of our current capabilities? And that will be the other, you know, the alien, the thing that is not us.
There's other theories, isn't there? Ultra-terrestrials, humans from the future, secret military stuff. And it gets so complicated, and none of it really explains everything.
I don't think everything can be explained, at least not by a single overarching theory. You know, there's not an explanation for UFO phenomenon. There are a dozen explanations. Ultra-terrestrials, as you say, you know, from other dimensions, humans from the future, aliens from the future. And as somebody pointed out, if during an alien abduction you're told something about their origin, about their background, why would you necessarily believe it? They tell different things to different people. You know, we'll have a whole mess of competing explanations as to where they are from. The classic grey, which have become the majority sighting of alien, they are popularly supposed to be from the twin star system Zeta Reticuli. And it's a good candidate. They are two sun-like stars. They orbit very close to each other, I think a few light weeks apart, the theory being that if life developed on one of them, look how close the other star is. You know, that would encourage space travel. But the Zeta Reticuli explanation comes from Betty and Barney's star map. If you remember that, I think it was a 1961 abduction. Betty was shown a map of stars, but they didn't have any labels. They didn't have anything on it. And it was the school teacher, Marjorie Fish, made a 3D model, you know, with the best known positions of the stars, adjusted it, you know, got ahead inside the model, looked here, looked there, and eventually matched up her model with the map that Betty had drawn. So that became the origin point, you know, for those aliens, which looked like greys, but not quite, you know, because the phenomenon evolves as it builds.
Wasn't it that the ETs that Betty and Barney Hill encountered were not the classic Greys. They didn't look exactly like that.
Yeah, not quite. You know, they had the bald heads, they had wide eyes, but Barney Hill said the leader had a Jimmy Durante nose, you know, a very prominent nose, and the modern Greys, you know, don't have that. I think that there's a lot of potentially unexplored territory in the field of semiotics, which is the study of signs, signifiers, language, and all that kind of thing. A pet theory, I'd have to work it out in a bit more detail. But the Greys have an easily remembered symbol, you know, an oval. Draw an oval, two more ovals for the eyes, and a small line. So four lines in total. That's a Grey. It's reducible to a symbol. I first saw a graffiti of that shape, you know, way back in the mid-90s, you know, at the height of the X-Files. And I don't think there's any comparable symbol you could have for, say, the Nordics, or the reptilians, the reptoids, or the hairy dwarves, which seem to be a feature in Brazilian adoption cases. So is it possible that because it's of that simplification that it becomes part of culture, and then culture builds on that? So we get, you know, kids' cartoons with, you know, Greys in them, we get TV shows with Greys in them. There's so much part of modern culture, so much part of modern American culture, that we even get comedy shows where they feature. So one of the other interesting things I saw one of the things I read was, I think it was the 1992 UFO yearbook. There was a sighting in South America, I think. But it had a drawing from the witness, and it's a flying saucer, okay, getting chased by a jet fighter. Right, so the drawing was UFO, jet fighter. But it wasn't a jet fighter. Generally, it was an F-14, which is a very specific jet fighter, you know, the Northrop Grumman F-14 Tomcat, variable geometry wings. I'm a bit of an aircraft buff. It has a very distinctive look. So the drawing of the aircraft here wasn't like that. It was, you know, fuselage, square wings, and two engine pods. It looked nothing like an F-14. And then I realized what he drew was a symbolic jet. And if that's the case, why is the UFO not also being drawn symbolically? No, so I think there's a lot of interesting things that could possibly be done in this area if they put the nuts and bolts exploration to one side, you know, just to one side for a wee bit, and see where that gets us. You know, can we predict what's going to happen in the future? Can we gain any insight? I honestly don't know how we could go about that, but these are the sort of things that interest me more than the idea that aliens are coming from another planet. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. You know, that's just the way it goes. But if I'm wrong, hey, I've learned something.
And there's so much we could get into with that as well, because some people talk about it.
Yeah.
Encountering ETs being a spiritually transformative experience. And,
yeah,
you know, that's a really big psychological hit on them, and they start their lives. They might talk about abductions that are happening when they're children, and it happens week after week, and they hate it and they fight against it. But after years, it's almost like the Stockholm syndrome, and they come to like the ET encounters, and it all changes.
Yeah, I've not read much about the positive encounters. I mean, my first encounter with the alien abduction phenomenon was reading Bud Hopkins' books, and with that, and with John Mack's books, it seemed that there was no doubt that it was an entirely malevolent thing that was happening. Yes. So I've got to admit, I was keeping a few sleepless nights, I can tell you.
But should we get on to some of the cases in the book?
Yeah, certainly.
Which was kind of the point of the interview. It's just fascinating. So I wanted to ask you about this one. It's 1957, I think it's called, is it the West Frow incident?
The West, I have never heard that pronounced out loud. So West Frough, I do not know. You know, even within Scotland, pronunciation of some names are just a surprise to me. But yes, here we go. Yeah, 1957. This is one of the most convincing sightings of an aerial object that I think is in there, because it was tracked by, I think, up to 3 radars at one point. This was an RAF, tracking radar mounted to a van. There was an RAF station, a few miles away. This object was detected. Now, unlike a surveillance radar, which, spins around, beep, 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 a tracking radar is pointed at the object and it has a continuous track. We had another one, and then they had another one, and it moved unlike an aircraft. It drifted along, it went up to, I think, 70,000 feet. Actually, check that. Extreme, 60,000 feet is an extreme altitude. But it made the news, and the RAF did not have any answers because they had tracked something and again lost it. It got studied. Nothing was seen visually. But at that point, in 1957, there was no aircraft in the world that could behave the same way. So, the report came back like decades later. The promised answers, didn't appear. The usual brushing off. But eventually, some of it made its way to the National Archives. One of the witnesses succeeded in getting more stuff released. And the official report, and this is the thing to bear in mind, is the official report said that basically it bore out. Let's see if we can read from that. The possibility of a balloon has been eliminated because the object was proceeding against the wind. It is concluded that the incident was due to the presence of 5 reflecting objects of unidentified type and origin. Now, that's from the government, the official sources. It couldn't have been a balloon, because of the wind. It couldn't have been an aircraft because of its behaviour. So it's the only possibility is that it was an unknown manufactured object. So, okay, aliens? Well, yeah, perhaps. One other possibility is that is it Paladin or Palladium? But it was a CIA radar spoofing device that the Americans were developing in that kind of time frame, whereby, clever use of recording the radar, playing it back but with a phase change, but with various things done to it, it can convince the radar that an object is further away, closer, somewhere else. So, okay, that's possible. But the timeline for the development of that system doesn't match. So even if we assume that, okay, it's one of the CIA's U2 with, this radar spoofing equipment, it's a bit of a stretch to say that caused the sighting. So, and again, there was 5 objects. Really, it's even all this time later, there is no convincing overall explanation for it. And that makes it one of the classic cases in my mind.
And it just goes in the list of weird things that were found, and there's never been an explanation for it. Another one I wanted to talk about was in 1967, which was Whitfield. And I think it was a lady called Jan Cusick.
Jan Cusick.
She saw loads of strange lights in the area of the Whitfield farm. And she saw sightings over several nights.
Yeah. Now, this is interesting to me for a number of reasons, because that is where I grew up. In 1967, Whitfield was Whitfield Farm. It became a housing scheme a few years later, and that's where I grew up. But it was one of those interesting cases that there's a lot of information, and this was in one of the UFO magazines with a promise of more information to come, but which never appeared. So it's, again, it's unlike the American sightings, unlike the, you know, there's no greys there, but there are creatures. Jan Cusack, I do have to wonder about the name because there was an address given and there was typos in that. So take that with a pinch of salt with the name. But yeah, there's a number of strange lights in the area of Whitfield Farm, and supposedly there have been strange lights seen, you know, throughout history. So, you know, maybe, you know, it's a focal spot, a UFO call, a window, something like that. But Jan and friends decided to investigate this. You know, they were walking along country paths for 3 miles, you know, seeing lights, chasing them, and they would get away. But on one night, they suddenly found themselves surrounded by disc-shaped lights, yellow glows, 25 feet across, no sound. And this is an interesting detail. The air was turning warm. Now, that reminds me of the Florida Scoutmasters sighting. That was in the 50s. That was one of the Blue Book classic cases where he was underneath this object and the air was turning warm. So, yeah, it's... What I like is, you know, putting together all this stuff and then just finding those little details that aren't popular, if you know what I mean. They're not well known. Like, you know, I think everybody knows what a grey looks like, you know, the eyes, but there's some tiny details that don't always appear.
Didn't they say that the people, the creatures they met, had large dorsal fin helmets?
Large dorsal fin helmets, yeah.
And they ran off at incredible speed.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. I mean, so there's another one in Scotland. The entities seem predisposed to having very fast movement, running fast inside the road, running, you know, through country lanes. I would like to get in touch if Cusick's still around, just to find out what happened, or look back in the, you know, the local Dundee archives, you know, newspaper archives, to find out, you know, what have the sightings been, you know, of lights and stuff like that. And if it's been lights, is it only until 1967 that they start becoming aliens?
1979 in Livingston, the Livingston incident with the two landmine shaped objects.
Yes, this is the classic Scottish UFO case, and it is one of the classics on the world stage. So, you know, Bob Taylor, you know, a forester, was doing his rounds one morning, around about 10 o'clock in the morning. You're walking up to Dechmont Law with his dog, and you know, turning the corner, he sees an object, a sphere with a rim around the side, two landmine looking things, you know, round with spikes dropped from this thing and started moving towards him. And he lost consciousness. When he awoke, it was all gone. He had rips in his trousers. He had, you know, physical evidence. He made it back to his house. His wife realized, oh, he's in a terrible state, you know, called the doctor. His boss heard of it, and somebody at some point, you know, notified the newspapers. But almost unique for any UFO case is that the police were also informed and treated it as an assault. So his boss organised a few people to go back up to Dechmont Law, where they discovered what appeared to be tank treads, or, you know, tread marks. They didn't come from anywhere. They didn't go to anywhere. They were just in this clearing. And a lot of indentations, which looked as if something went pop, 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 all the way around in circles. So there was something physical actually there. Bob later got hypnotized. He unfortunately didn't remember anything new. The police, as far as I know, still have it as an open assault case. which is unique in, you know, in the world. So when I was putting all this together, there was quite an extensive report from BUFRA, you know, the British UFO Research Association, you know, around too many pages. It's a good case because there are drawings taken, there are photos of the site taken, samples were taken. Unfortunately, they got contaminated on the way to the laboratory, so you read into that what you will. But I also found one of those little details that doesn't get mentioned a lot. The object Bob saw had lots of little propellers, or what appeared to be propellers, around the perimeter. They may have been aerials. They may have been something entirely different, but to him, they looked like tiny propellers. And I found a case a few weeks earlier than that that also described little propellers. There was a case, there was a sighting around the same time. There were quite a number in the week preceding, and I think a few after. Not to say they're all connected, but I mean, it's certainly intriguing. And all these years later, you know, there's still not been any convincing explanation. There have been some suggestions, like Bob got poisoned by some berries on the air, which doesn't really pan out. You know, some testing of, you know, a military device. Again, you know, it doesn't really work. You know, somebody would have seen it arrive and leave, because such a thing could only go by helicopter, not seen. It just, it's one of those ones that defies most attempts, all attempts, really, to explain it away. So we can't say it was a hallucination. There was physical evidence. The physical evidence, and, you know, the trouser tears. Now, Bob wore, what was it, police issue trousers, you know, sort of thick fabric. And the analysis of those trousers, because again, we've got an analysis of evidence, reveals that it could only have been caught in an upward motion. Okay, maybe he could have caught himself on a fence, but that wouldn't have been enough. You know, barbed wire wouldn't have done that. It was a deeper tear. Common tools, pliers, you know, they tried that, didn't have the same result. So it was something tugging him towards this object. And that's a bit scary, isn't it?
And did he have missing time?
He had about 20 minutes unconscious. As I say, hypnosis didn't reveal anything. He never had any more details other than just what he saw visually. So it does seem that he was only unconscious. There wasn't any missing time. Now, I've seen, you know, what one of the UFO channels have Nick Pope on, and Nick Pope said, you know, Bob thought that he was in this object for 20 minutes. That appears nowhere in any of the literature that I've read, not in the report from BUFRA, not in the report done for Flying Saucer Review. So I don't think there was any missing time, no.
But can we move on to another case? It's October 1980, it's Jedburgh. And there's a couple of interesting things there, because she said, I think she was in the car with children and there was an object. And one of the interesting things was she said there was a camera in the back of the car, but when she reached for it, she became overcome with terror, which kind of suggests like it was almost something inside this UFO knew she was going for a camera. So did something telepathically to stop her using it? Or am I going too far?
Well, it depends on what you think the ultimate answer to the mystery is. Yeah, I mean, this is a case that appears on the BUFRA's website. It's interesting in a number of ways. It's from the 80s onwards, we get these black triangles, which some suggest that we have, if UFOs, disc-shaped craft, are alien, then the black triangles are humans' attempt at reverse engineering that rather than alien craft themselves. Yeah, you know, I don't know. I don't know, but they appear everywhere, but they act the same. Silent, hovering, beams of light. And now that I think of it, aren't the beams of light more of a recent thing, you know, since the 80s. I'm digressing. So that would be terrifying. If you did see this thing, and I'm going to get evidence of it, isn't it better from your point of view to not?
I think they say what should have been an hour's drive took 7 hours, so that they lost 6 hours.
Yeah. I mean, that sort of thing, it's hard to get a handle on it. If you take it at face value, it's disturbing. It really is. It's one of a few missing time cases, but what I've found is that there's very little in the archives that say what the content of that missing time was. I mean, Bufra, you know, quite famously had an injunction against doing hypnosis, you know, to uncover these things, because it is too easy for the beliefs of the experimenter to implant that. What comes out from hypnosis is not necessarily the truth, but again has, you know, the culture and the social baggage. I don't know if I'm making too much sense here, but yeah, but it's one of those things, you know, you can't just dismiss it.
Yeah.
I would be, I mean, you know, because of my own experience, I would be happier than it would have been to say, well, you know, maybe it was all psychological and stuff like that, but that's not really fair, is it? Because missing time, if you're here, you end up here, too much time has elapsed, you know, that is physical evidence of a kind.
Yeah, and you have multiple witnesses that all lose time as well. It's not just one person who might have made a mistake.
Yeah. So I think if my ideas can, you know, solve some of the mystery, that certainly leaves a lot still to be explained.
Talking about missing time, there's the A70 abduction. They had 2 hours missing. So what happened with that case?
Yes, that's Gary Wood and his friend. They, you know, driving, it all seems to be driving, which is interesting. You know, driving, you know, rounding a corner, they saw a disc-shaped craft. It was like a double disc-shaped craft, you know, which is, again, an interesting description, you know, an unusual detail, you know, with a kind of sparkling rain fall through it. As they drove underneath it, suddenly he's in a ditch. It was gone. They get to their friends and, you know, 2 hours have gone past. It should have only taken 20 minutes. This is the only one that I've found that is, you know, almost like the, you know, the classic, you know, grey abduction scenario. You, with recovered memories, you know, they find themselves taken on board the craft, lying on the table. There's greys there. There's a lot of detail to it. I think Malcolm Robson's got an entire book about that, which I'll have to get around to buying. But from what I've read on it so far, I find, okay, so they've got a lot of the elements of the standard abduction scenario. But there's also a few things that it's like, that's interesting. That also happens in other cases, but no one's really heard of it. And that is that the greys or the entities were being directed or apparently directed by what looked like a human in a suit. Okay. So, you know, if you ask, you know, the average person off the street, what's an alien abduction like, you know, they'll be able to tell you a lot, but none of them would tell you that detail. And that detail has actually cropped up quite a bit in America. I don't know of any other Scottish case. You know, a man in control of proceedings. One document that I had my attention drawn to just in the last year. I mean, I don't know if you listen to The Saucer Life, which does a lot of history for all this, but there's a 1990 document, 30,000 words, called The Controllers, and that goes through this hypothesis and provides evidence for this hypothesis that alien abductions, or a chunk of them, a large amount of them, were, are in actual fact mind control experiments by the CIA. Now, as soon as you mentioned CIA mind control, you know, it's funny. But looking, you're reading through this, and it makes a great case. You know, so is it in their interests to cover up all the shenanigans that they're doing by putting out UFO stories? So if something happens to somebody, and it's them behind it, they think it's UFOs, and the attention gets deflected elsewhere. It's, you know, I'm not saying that is the case. What I'm saying is that I lost a few nights sleep over that one, reading about it.
It's another theory, isn't it?
It's another theory. So, you know, perhaps the ultimate explanation is that there's, you know, four or five main theories that they all slot together. Perhaps it's probably something that nobody's thought of yet.
Yeah, and also, didn't he say one morning he found himself a mile from his house and he didn't know how he got there?
Gary, yes. Yeah, that's scary as well. For experiencers or percipients, it's not just a case of having an encounter and that's it done. It could be having an encounter and that has ramifications, you know, for the rest of your life, perhaps, you know, for weeks, for months, for years. Unusual things can happen to you. Maybe not, but they might do, and it could all be related. So I don't think he's had anything much since then, but again, I'd have to read Malcolm's book to get up to speed with that.
And also, I think he said that this was during the tour, missing hours or something. He talked about finding himself in a transparent box, and he could see other naked people in similar containers.
Yeah, I mean, that's another detail that's not very commonly known. You know, being abducted, but you're part of a batch, that there's other people there, and, you know, occasionally some people that you know. I think Gary said that he would know this woman if he saw her again. He would recognize her, but so far he hasn't encountered her. So, you know, that could work the other way around. You know, is she still out there? Is she interested in this subject? Is she trying to avoid it? You know, what would happen if we got them together, you know, for corroborating the story?
Well, maybe she has to have no recollection of it at all.
You know, very possibly. But I mean, you know, there's all this extra stuff we can still do. I mean, I make a big deal about in the introduction of my book about what we've really got to work with is stories, which it sounds like it is selling it short slightly. I mean, for somebody like me, you know, because I haven't really spoken to any witnesses, although I did do a very small amount of that when I ran the Azufra website, which it was a small Scottish group around about 2000 to 2004. I did the website. I did speak to a few people. And I did get a phone call once from a woman who was worried that, you know, she had been abducted. But in that case, the interesting thing was that she only started thinking that because she'd seen a film a few days earlier. Whether it was Communion or Fire in the Sky, I can't remember which, but so, you know, I tried to reassure her, but, you know, it's possibly just, you know, something prosaic, because UFOs and alien abductions, you know, whatever you believe in, they do have a way of getting under your skin, you know?
There is physical evidence in Scotland. Do you ever get many crop circles in Scotland?
No. I don't think there's been any for, you know, quite some time. I've got to admit, When putting the list of cases together, I did have to decide, you know, or make a decision about what goes in and what doesn't go in. You know, for a UFO casebook, well, entities, that's not too much of a stretch, but I did make a specific point of not including crop circles. I don't recall seeing many in the news clippings. Mainly that was in England, so it could have escaped my attention, but as far as I can tell, there haven't really been.
What about cattle mutilations? Has that ever cropped up?
I haven't seen any. No, I mean, it's again, that seems to be an American phenomenon. You know, whether they have the predators that can do that, whether they are being targeted by, you know, unknown forces. Or, you know, to be generous, maybe it's just that it does happen here, but nobody wants to talk about it. But I haven't seen anything written down about it. I haven't seen any claims being made about it. So all I can say is, no, I don't think there is.
So what do you make of the Calvin vote?
Yeah, just right after I publish, I'm going to have to do a second edition now, I'm going to bring the story up to date. That was some amazing detective work by David Clark. My hat's off to him. I do have to say, though, the photo, it's kind of disappointing. You know, because, you know, so far, you know, up until now, there's been this rather grainy photocopy, which may even be a photocopy of a line drawing over the photo. So it's not been a lot to go on. Nick Pope came up with a recreation of that photo based on his memories. And I think that is what everyone's got in their mind when they think Calvin, the Calvin photo. So when the real thing comes up, well, yeah, that's interesting. It's a lot lower quality than I would have hoped. That said, I spent days with the high res version of that. I think you can download it from the Sheffield Alarm University, and I spent days with that. You know, just putting it into the computer, and you know, trying all sorts of enhancements, and you know, I couldn't see anything more on it. To me, if it's a craft, then it looks like it's tipped towards us. You know, we're seeing it from the top as if it's banking. There's been a lot of discussion about it. Is it actually just something floating on the top of the water? Is it something dangling from the tree? And when it comes down to these different interpretations, you know, then you go back to, well, what does the testimony say? And the witness said it took off at high speed vertically. And if that's the case, then it's like no aircraft that we know of, you know. So,
well, it's been great talking to you. The book we've been talking about is the Scottish UFO Casebook, and that's on Amazon, isn't it?
It's on Amazon Kindle, and it's also available in paperback from lulu.com. So you just search for the Scottish UFO Casebook, and that should take you there.
And can you give us the address of your website and what we can find there?
Okay, it's www.stevehammond.org. There's some UFO material there. I go into the background of my interest in it and a few times from my past where I encountered the UFO phenomenon. Mostly it's about my time in the games industry, about writing. I do comic lettering. But I also have a page where I list other Scottish UFO sightings, the ones which were self-reported on the web, you know, not the ones from newspapers. It's a different kind of category, which I think makes a nice distinction. And also there is a free version of the Scottish UFO Casebook on there. It contains less sightings, but otherwise it's complete and it's free. You can't argue with free.
And I'll put these links in the show notes so people can go straight to them.
Okay.
Well, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Okay, it's been my pleasure.
And that was an interview with Steve Hammond about his book, The Scottish UFO Casebook. And if you want to hear the rest of this fascinating interview, you'll need to sign up to Patreon for the extended episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. If you join the $4.50 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month. If you join the $7.50 a month tier, you'll have access to an extended episode every week. When you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and released 2 days before the free versions. And please check out my other podcast. It's called Past Lives Podcast. There are over 250 episodes. On the Past Lives Podcast, I look into evidence of an afterlife, such as near-death experiences, children with past life memories, mediumship, deathbed visions, and other phenomena. and also release an extra episode of the Past Lives podcast every Thursday called Paranormal Stories. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening. And were there six pictures taken?
Six in total. It's one of those stories that becomes legendary because of the history behind it. The photos were taken.